Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, bad, and crazy martinis for you. As usual, we started, Jim, the government shutdown with a 3.5 martini lunch in order to compensate for the lack of production from the federal government. And since the shutdown is now over, I figure it's an appropriate bookend to the shutdown as well.
Well, actually, I was going to cut it actually 25% and make it, you know, only 2.25 martini lunch. But because the good one is kind of on the smaller side. But, you know, the fact that the government has reopened, the fact that the debt ceiling has not been crashed through, and the fact that Republicans are out of this circumstance in which they were getting blamed for the shutdown. If you're in a bad situation, get out of that situation, and it is. And I think this entire circumstance will look better as it goes further and further into our rearview mirror.
That's the point I think we agreed most on yesterday in our little debate over the lessons learned in the government shutdown and the debt ceiling fight that we had. And that's that Republicans had a tough hand to play, a decent hand to play, and there was a tipping point a few days into this shutdown where the momentum clearly was going against them. So getting out, obviously, would have liked a better deal than we got. The fact that the bleeding was stopped, I think, is the best part. And obviously, the fact that our credit rating, unless you're the Chinese, is still decent.
Yeah. You know, I mean, yay, we're still a AAA rated country in the eyes of some of the rating agencies, slightly below that and a few others. If you, like me, believe that a default would have ended up with some serious consequences, we did not endure the worst-case scenario. We endured the second-worst-case scenario. So now we just have the $17 trillion debt to worry about, that's all.
And we get to do this all over again in a few months.
Exactly, yeah. Just in time for next year. So, next year is going to be awesome!
So. All right, on to martini number 2A, and this is kind of the downside of the deal. And when you actually get a chance to page through some of this, there's some things that make you scratch your head and grumble, and especially when you find out that it's the folks on the right who put it in here. And here's just one little clip from Politico. It says this: the legislation also includes a McConnell written proposal that would allow Congress to disapprove of the debt ceiling increase. Lawmakers will formally vote on rejecting the bump of the borrowing limit. If passed, it could be vetoed by Obama. Which means now, Jim, you need 67 votes to force the president's hand. If you thought 51 was hard, 67 is pretty much impossible. So Obama's got carte blanche now.
What this kind of suggests is that the debt ceiling is not really as useful a bargaining chip as Republicans hoped. In order to win a funding fight like this, you largely need to win the messaging game. And, you know, the White House is almost always going to have the advantage in those circumstances. It is speaking with one voice, and it has all the trappings and grandeur of the Oval Office and the presidency, whereas Congress has always got a whole bunch of people who think they're in charge. And even if the person they don't have the charge and title, they're always kind of scrambling to be the one in front of the cameras, the one who's being the deal maker, and things like that. It's always very hard to keep your group unified. This may suggest that this kind of budgetary brinksmanship is not really working all that well for Republicans, and that they're not all that interested in using the debt ceiling as their primary point of leverage. Now, I think what you can do is you can get a lot of, you know, ticky-tack small items as a concession, but you cannot get something as wholesale as repeal of Obamacare or a one-year delay in the individual mandate or things like that. So because nobody wants to run into the debt ceiling, it's got to go up. And as a result of that, whatever deal is on the table at the 11th hour is what everybody has to end up voting for. And so I think what we're seeing here is that, you know, you can point this as McConnell not having enough stomach to fight, but unless you're really willing to go over the edge, I'm not so sure this brinksmanship has really proven to be as effective for Republicans as they hoped it was going to be.
I think it's a bad precedent, though, because it essentially leaves the legislative branch out of the process unless you have an overwhelming majority for your position. Because if you can do it on this issue, you can conceivably throw it into other key votes that Congress has to do as well. So to basically remove any sort of potential leverage, regardless of which party's in Congress or which party's in the White House, it's kind of abdicating a key responsibility. And I think it's a lot of – they don't like to have to take tough, unpopular votes, and so this is their way of getting out of it.
One thing that's exacerbating the frequency of these budgetary debt ceiling fights is that we're running up debt a lot faster than we used to.
Yes.
$500 billion was considered a really terrible year until the Obama years began, that basically we'd hit that level twice – once you adjust for inflation going back decades and decades. Then the Obama years began, and a trillion was a good year. You know, we had close to $2 trillion that first year. When you throw in TARP, you throw in the stimulus, and it had been above a trillion in 2010, 2011, and 2012. And it looks like 2013, it might be great news, Greg. We might be less than a trillion. So the best year for Obama is still going to be the fifth worst year ever, which is why you run up against the debt ceiling a lot faster than you used to. And we have these fights a lot more frequently than we used to. In other words, if you want to avoid these, you know, brinksmanship on the debt ceilings, you got to spend less quickly, which is something Republicans have been fighting from day one.
On to Martini number 2B, and this one, unfortunately, was expected, and that is that Cory Booker is, in fact, set to be the brand new senator from New Jersey as soon as he gets to Washington and gets sworn in. He replaces Frank Lautenberg, beats Steve Lonergan, 55-44, which, if you had predicted that margin a couple months ago, a lot of folks on the left would have called you crazy, so perhaps it's because it was a special election, there weren't other key races on the ballot or what have you, but Lonergan ran a tough campaign, and Cory Booker obviously suffered some reputation damage during this campaign. But now the question, Jim, I guess, is whether T-Bone becomes chief of staff.
T-Bone was not available for comment. Could not be reached, could not be found. I also really was hoping you'd see more write-in votes for Eliana Johnson, who I think has really been the toughest opponent Cory Booker has seen in this campaign. No, yeah, actually, there's a little bit of – we can give some credit to Steve Lonergan. By the way, Steve Lonergan is a mayor of – I believe it's Bogota. It's not Bogota. New Jersey didn't have a very big base. He ran against Christie back in 2009, down the line Tea Party conservative Republican. And that's kind of tough to elect in a blue state like New Jersey. Lonergan got 44.3% of the vote, which is actually tied for the best any Republican has done in a Senate race since the year 2000. Republicans have a very tough time in New Jersey, and they tend to have a really, really tough time in Senate races. Turnout was in the neighborhood of about 1.2, 1.3 million votes. Usually you get about 2 million or 3 million in a regular year. So there's some good news here. Even though this is our bad martini, we're going to be putting up with Senator Cory Booker for at least the next 2 years or so, and probably like 18 months or so, and probably a good portion of the time after that. There is some good news in the sense that, look, so here's Steve Lonergan, not the most charismatic candidate, not the most natural poster boy for Republicans. It's literally going on during the government shutdown. It's literally going on as this fight is going on in Washington and destroying the Republican image. And he does as well as any Republican has in 13 years. As one person, I think it was Phil Kirpin, who was doing everything humanly possible to help Lonergan in this race, he had observed, you're dealing with a circumstance in which either this was a single-digit race recently, which honestly only Lonergan's internal polls showed. Most of them had it topping out around a 9, 10, 11-point margin. Or the shutdown and all the fights in Washington had really no impact whatsoever on an election in New Jersey. And if it didn't have an impact on an election right now in New Jersey, is it really going to have a really big impact in, say, North Carolina in November 2014, in Arkansas in November 2014, in Alaska? You know, all these big Senate races coming up in 2014 – probably aren't going to be that big. It's really kind of hard to imagine it's going to have a bigger impact then and there than it did here and now. You want to do better than 44.3% of the vote, but considering the circumstances, you know, this is not that bad a result for Republicans.
One more slight bad martini, maybe even bigger than slight. This election happened yesterday for, well, two reasons. One, because Frank Lautenberg died, but secondly, because Chris Christie decided that his appointment shouldn't serve out the rest of the term through 2014, which he was perfectly legitimate in appointing him to do. So we could have had a Republican in Jeff Keza who could have been there till right after Election Day 2014, but for some reason that couldn't be done. So thanks, Governor Christie. On to martini number 3 now, and back to the government shutdown. And I kind of talked about that. We both talked about this yesterday in a way that many conservatives might not agree with. But I think this time that John Boehner acquitted himself pretty well. In previous debates with the president, he kind of stiff-armed, a lot of people think, the conservative Tea Party wing of the party. This time, I think he tried to accommodate them as much as humanly possible. The griping is still out there that he rolled over, that the Republicans rolled over, and there's an argument to be made for that. But it seems to me, Jim, that John Boehner went as far as possible, and the people who are out for his head this time have far less of an argument than they've ever had in the past.
Yeah, and let me put it this way, too, because we've also hearing a lot of arguments about McConnell this morning. And let me just say to anybody who wants to replace either one of these guys, you can't replace somebody with nobody. You might really love, say, Tim Scott, the newly appointed, you know, a relatively newly appointed senator from South Carolina, Republican. You might like Ted Cruz, but Ted Cruz, Scott, none of these guys are running for Senate Minority Leader. At any point, they could say, I want that job, and I'm running for that job. Michelle Bachmann is retiring, but, you know, Scott Garrett of New Jersey, I'm trying to think of other good, you know, down-the-line conservative Republican House members. They can always challenge John Boehner, but they're not doing so. And very few have said that they're interested in doing so. Tom Price of Georgia has been mentioned a little bit. The opportunity is always there to say, look, I would like to have a new vote for Speaker, and I would like to do it, and I believe that there is more support for me than there is for Boehner in the Republican caucus. The thing is that there's still more support for Boehner in the Republican caucus because it's a really tough job. As I've mentioned probably in previous editions of this podcast, we don't really have a majority caucus and a minority caucus in the U.S. House. We have three minority caucuses. We have Democrats, we have Republicans, and we have Tea Party. And the Tea Party folks could range anywhere from 30 to 60, depending on the issue. Those 30 to 60 are going to be really grumpy with John Boehner a bunch of the time. And they're going to think he's not pushing hard enough. And they're going to think he's not fighting hard enough. Who's probably the best example of the distilled essence of the Tea Party in the House, Greg?
Oh, you could go with Jim Jordan, Steve King.
Let's say, for the sake of argument, Steve King. Let's say someday we have House Speaker Steve King, and both liberal listeners of this podcast just fainted from shock and horror at that thought. But the day that happens and Steve King goes into negotiations with President Obama over the budget or something like that, they'd go into negotiations and they'd come out with something. And chances are Steve King would come out with a deal that wasn't everything he wanted. It would be a compromise. It would be a half a loaf, maybe three quarters of a loaf. Maybe you'd get, slightly better than you would with Boehner. But they'd come out and then all of a sudden the storyline would be people would say, oh, my God, what happened to Steve King? He turned into a sellout. He got soft. He turned into a squish. In other words, the easiest way to remain pure is to never have any responsibility, to ever, never be in charge of leading a group of people and trying to get, and never having to say, I got the best deal I could. This is the best that can happen. It's very easy to be uncompromising when you're not interested in compromising. For a lot of these guys in the Tea Party caucus, putting them in charge would put them on the spot and they'd have to get the best of the deal. And they might realize, oh, they can't really do that job much better than John Boehner is. Meaning that I have, plenty of reasons. Look, there's a lot of reasons to not like John Boehner. But I don't think there are a lot of people who could be doing that job that much better than he is, because ultimately what the issue is not John Boehner. The issue is a House Republican caucus that has a very wide spectrum to it. It goes from Peter King to Steve King, a pretty big ideological divide there. And it's very tough to find a deal that's going to satisfy both of them. And as a result of that, Boehner doesn't have that much leeway to really negotiate with Obama and horse trade and, to hold out for some areas and make concessions on other areas. So that's why we are where we are. Ultimately, he reflects his caucus. And if he seems, muddled and unspecific and having a hard time drawing hard lines, it's because his caucus is that way. And, if you want to change the speaker, change the caucus.
Well, on that note, we will adjourn until Friday for the 3 Martini Lunch. Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to join us again on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.